This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and Ian Knauer joins us with a look at great ways to use fresh honey.
First, an iron mine in northern Wisconsin continues to be a hot topic, and it's brought the Honor the Earth Tour to Wisconsin this weekend. Featuring music by the Indigo Girls, the tour aims to draw attention to environmental issues facing Native American tribes around the country.
Earlier today, I talked to the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, about the tour and why they're here in Wisconsin. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah.
And Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So Honor the Earth started 20 years ago. Emily, when you and Winona LaDuke and the other folks involved started it, what was the goal?
Well, we were at an Earth Day concert at Foxborough Stadium in Massachusetts, and Amy started speaking with Winona LaDuke after she had spoken to the crowd, and we had been doing some sort of mainstream environmental activism with groups like Greenpeace and other mainstream groups. And then after talking with Winona, both of us realized that we could only from that point on begin to view our environmental, view environmentalism through the lens of the indigenous perspective. And so Honor the Earth was created with Winona and some other Native American activists. And then Amy and I became sort of a liaison and the musical liaison between Indian and non-Indian communities to focus on different issues like cultural issues and environmental sustainability. And now we find ourselves, as we have been over the course of Honor the Earth, focused on environmental justice issues, which brings us to Wisconsin, and the proposed Gugibic Taconic Mine, which we find a horrible idea. That's why we're here, and that's a little bit of history of Honor the Earth and what we focus on.
And Amy, as Emily just mentioned, the big issue here in Wisconsin and the environment is mining. Is this something you're seeing not just here in Wisconsin, but as a tribal and environmental issue around the country?
Yeah, I mean, we've been seeing this for this has been going on for so long. It's like we did some work with mining issues a long time ago in Wisconsin with another mine, and we've worked in, you know, various parts of the country. But, I mean, I would say that right now there seems like there's an aggressive sort of pro-mining stance generally. And I think it's because, you know, we have the tar sands in Canada, we have the pipelines we're talking about, we have fracking we're talking about, we have all these different forms of mining. And I think one of the things that's happened is we had a bad economic time, and there's a real need for jobs. And I think we always talk about jobs versus no jobs when we're talking about mining. We definitely have newer technologies, but also the resources have been gutted a bit. So we're trying to extract, you know, ores and minerals from, you know, things that we didn't think we could get them from before. So you end up having, a taconite mine where we're getting iron ore out of taconite. You end up having tar sands where we're getting oil out of tar sands. And, you know, we've advanced in our technology to be able to do that, but at the same time, it's more destructive because you're getting, you know, you're having to go through a lot more resources to get a lot less mineral and ore. And I think generally the picture that we've seen, though, has been that over and over again, treaty rights have been ignored, and Native people haven't been asked to the table to negotiate and to talk about the environmental impact on their area, as well as community people haven't been asked. You know, I think what happens is the government says, you know, we have, like in Wisconsin, for instance, they had all these great protections, and then all of a sudden, you know, Scott Walker was like, you know, we need to streamline this process, and all of a sudden, before you know it, there's new legislation and gutting the environmental parts of the old mining law. And so I think that's happening everywhere, because I think they want to expedite the mining because they don't want to have a light shown on it. They don't want to have the impact on the ecosystem shown. And I think what I think we should do is, you know, step back and look at these more and look at other ways we have to get energy and look at the impact that these mines have and the long-term effect, because it's great to get jobs short term, but if you're ruining the environment, you're basically trading in your public health and your ecosystem health, and things like ecotourism and all the people that come to the, you know, great part of northern Wisconsin to do fishing and hunting and snowmobiling and everything that happens up here. And I think you trade that in for a short-term amount of jobs, and it's not as many jobs as you think it'd be because technology is so advanced that you don't need as many jobs. And so that, to me, is like what we're seeing all over the, you know, all over the country in different mining areas, and constantly over and over again, the tribes will get left out of the equation.
Emily, as you travel the country doing the Honor the Earth tour, do you get a sense that everybody's kind of fighting their own local battle, or is there a sense that people need to make connections from state to state, country to country on these issues?
I mean, I think in this digital information world, it is sometimes hard to make the larger picture connections, but it's one of our goals is to, you know, obviously local communities, when it happens in your own backyard, it's when you tend to get the most fired up, and then to have a holistic approach to the to making the connections and seeing how this is a widespread, these environmental issues and our relationships with the tribes and, you know, these widespread issues affect all of us. But what you start with the communities and the voice of the people who live there and those who are affected by these issues, and then you connect the dots. And as I say, it's more difficult to speak succinctly about a holistic approach and the problems, but it's definitely important that we make those connections. You know, in a short attention span culture, as I say, that's a great challenge. But the most important thing, first and foremost, is to try to, you know, stop the mines and stop the environmental destruction. And this mine here in Wisconsin is a terrible example of something that is, as Amy said, has been going on because of all the reasons she listed, but it is something that can be stopped. And, you know, if you want to talk about a big picture, when you're talking about the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa, you're talking about potential genocide of a people. And this is huge. And you can make a link to the Syrian war. What are we potentially going into another country because we're so offended by the use of chemical weaponry? And yet, back here in Wisconsin, you're facing with the genocide of a tribal people. And what about that? It's the same sort of destruction and ending of life through environmental devastation. Those are the dots and points that we need to connect worldwide. But we need to start in our local communities and with the tribes and stop the mines and then get to the table to discuss the big issues.
Looking back at the history of the Honor the Earth Tour, when you started it 20 years ago, Amy, did you think you'd still be at it 20 years later?
I'll say that we hoped we would, you know, if it was needed. I mean, obviously, you hope at some point that you don't need Honor the Earth, but or that it just becomes like a celebratory group. But I think, you know, these are all the stuff we're working on is pretty long term, and we jumped into the environmental world of Native activism when they were already well underway working on issues that we're still working on. I mean, they come and they go, but it's the same paradigm that you're fighting, which is, you know, putting profit before the health of the ecosystem and the health of the human community. And so, you know, I think that what we did know is that we would have a long-term vision and we would stick with it as long as we could and as long as the group could exist. But we sort of exist at the behest of all of the other Native groups doing work, because what we really do is we try to amplify Native groups across the Americas that are doing environmental work. And so as long as they're doing work, we're going to be here to amplify them and to fund them in as much as we can. And that's kind of what our goal was.
And I wanted to ask both of you, Emily, first, has your involvement with Honor the Earth and other activism changed the way you create music in Indigo Girls or on your own?
That's a good question. I think that everything that you're involved with that speaks to your soul and to your sort of reason for or your belief in your part in a larger community affects your art and in ways that sometimes can be traced clearly, like if a song in its lyrics deals specifically with an environmental issue or a celebration of the land or our connectivity to the land and its peoples. And then sometimes it can't be articulated. It's just something that stirs within your soul that affects your art. There's no doubt that these long-term relationships with indigenous groups and even non-indigenous groups who are fighting the same battles to protect the environment are things that are very inspiring. They're sometimes disheartening. it's the great struggles, you know, over resources and what we need to protect and celebrate. All those things play in your art, whether specifically in the lyrics or whether in the way it moves your approach to writing. So there's no doubt that this has had an effect. And then just plain and simple, all the amazing people we've met through this work with Honor the Earth, and just having good people like that around, it keeps your creative fires fired, you know? So when you sit down to write a song, all that stuff comes out. It's a beautiful gift.
Amy, anything to add to that?
Oh, I think that pretty much sums it up.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for being here, and thanks for being on the air. We appreciate it.
And Emily, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, otherwise known as the Indigo Girls, and they're co-founders of Honor the Earth.
They're playing tonight in Madison at the Capitol Theater, tomorrow in St. Paul, Minnesota at the O'Shaughnessy Auditorium, Sunday at Big Top Chautauqua.
Coming up, it's Food Friday, and food writer Ian Knauer joins us to celebrate National Honey Month. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Bee lovers rejoice, for September is National Honey Month. So for this Food Friday, we celebrate the sweet stuff from our little stripey friends with Ian Knauer.
Ian's a food writer who spent 10 years at Gourmet Magazine. These days, he's running The Family Farm in Pennsylvania, where he writes, cooks, gardens, and keeps bees. He's also hosting a new PBS series. It's due out in November called The Farm, and that's named after his cookbook by the same name. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
So September is National Honey Month, and I guess the question is, what's not to like about that?
Nothing. It's the sweetest month all year.
So you keep bees at your farm in Pennsylvania, something that's catching on around the country. Tell us a little bit about what it's like being up close and personal with the source of your honey.
Keeping bees is probably one of the most intimate ways to get in touch with nature and with yourself. If you know a beekeeper, chances are they're pretty calm, because it's true. I mean, this old maxim about how bees can smell fear is absolutely true. Well, I don't know if they actually smell it. I'm not sure that they have noses, but they can sense it. And I notice a huge difference in my hive when I go in. If I'm in a bad mood or if I'm stressed, the bees also become stressed. So what you learn as a beekeeper is to really relax yourself, and the bees will follow right with you, because you don't like to get stung. And so when you learn how to make yourself calm, the bees will follow suit. And if you do that enough, then you can transfer that out of the hive and into your regular life. So, you know, beekeepers tend to be pretty chill.
So it'll be The Zen of Beekeeping, your next book.
Exactly. Right.
I always want to keep bees. I'm tempted by it, but my kids keep voting me down. Apparently they think they're going to get stung or something. And I keep telling them, you know, bees are our friends, guys. You don't need to worry about it. But it sounds like you're saying it's sort of more about you than it is about the bees.
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, they are sensitive to some other external factors, like the weather, for instance. They don't really like it when it's rainy and cloudy. They get a little cranky. So you just avoid them at that time. And, you know, you steer clear and you let them have their space. And then when it's sunny out and nice, like it is today over in this part of the country, today is a perfect day to go into the hive, and they're actually really happy to see you. So as long as you don't, you know, egg them on, and you know how to be sensitive to the bees, then the bees will just return the favor.
Let's get to the eating part now. I keep honey around. I eat it in fits and starts. Usually when I go to get it, I have to kind of chisel it out with a butter knife. How much of a difference does it make to have fresh honey?
Well, honey never goes bad, so let's start from that end. Even in some excavations of tombs in Egypt, they found jars of honey that was still good.
Wow.
There's just so much sugar in it that bacteria can't set in, so it doesn't rot. Now, it does crystallize, so that's what you experience when you have to chip it out. That doesn't mean it's bad at all. In fact, a lot of people prefer it that way. It's much more spreadable. Or if you like your honey liquefied, you can always just warm up your jar in some warm water, or even stick in the microwave for a couple seconds, and it'll become a liquid again. Now, that said, fresh honey is its own wonderful, just incredible thing. And if you get it right from the hive, or you get it from a local farmer or a local beekeeper who has just taken the honey, it tastes totally different than it does 6 months later or a year later, and you can really taste those flowers. It's very, very floral. So if you get a chance to either keep your own bees or you know a beekeeper, see if you can get your hands on some really fresh honey.
So judging by the varieties of honey available at my farmer's market, it seems like you can literally kind of taste what it is that the bees are eating. Do you find that?
I think in some cases, yeah. I think with orange flower honey, for instance, it really tastes like oranges to me. It's very citrus. Now, when it comes to something like lavender honey, I don't actually taste lavender. I think it's delicious, but I really have to squint and use my imagination to get lavender flavor from the honey. But, you know, I think it really depends. Buckwheat honey, of course, is its own really dark, almost molasses-like flavor. And then chestnut honey, if you ever get your hands on some chestnut honey, especially from Italy, it's almost funky. I mean, there's something really ripe about it. So it varies from location to location, and of course from flower to flower, and you can get such a wide range of flavors of honey that you can play with them. You know, it's fun to play with those different flavors.
We got a sneak peek at your PBS series called The Farm, and we got a look at you eating just some biscuits with honey drizzled on them. Is that the best way to enjoy some honey?
If you have honey fresh from the hive, you know, and it was just harvested, then that's the way that you want to eat it, just unadulterated on a very plain canvas, like a biscuit is a great example of that, or some toast. You really get the nuanced flavors of that fresh honey. But I also like to cook with honey, not only in sweet dishes, but savory dishes too. It can be a really fun ingredient, a nice way to add balance and a little bit of sweetness to a savory dish.
Well, now, speaking of recipes and savory dishes, you shared one with us, and it's one that, of course, employs honey. Honey chipotle ribs. Can you tell us a bit about that recipe?
This is basically everybody's favorite this time of year. You get a really nice balance because you have those chipotle peppers, which are smoky and a little spicy, as the base of this rub that goes on the ribs. And then to balance that out, I add a little fresh lime juice and, of course, some honey. And so you really get a complete flavor profile here. You get the acidity, the sweetness, the smokiness, and the heat. And, of course, you know, ribs all by themselves are pretty delicious things. So this just bumps up the flavor by like 1,000%. It's a really simple marinade to put together. You basically just chop your chipotles and whisk it all together. And then you drizzle it on the ribs and then cook them in the oven. I like to cook them in like a foil packet. That basically means that they steam in the marinade and in their own juices. So like an hour and three quarters or so until they're just falling off the bone. And then I undo the foil package and I either grill them to finish them or I put them under the broiler for like 4 or 5 minutes just to get a little brown on top. It's one of those recipes that takes a couple hours, but it's not active time. You can throw them in the oven and then forget about them and then come back at dinner time. So it's actually really easy.
And can you send some of those ribs over for us right now?
It's kind of cruel to be talking about this as we enter the dinner hour. I see Rob salivating over there.
Literally.
Yeah.
Can you put that on other stuff besides ribs? Chicken, shrimp?
Yeah, it'd be great on, grilled chicken would be amazing with that. You could just stand at the grill and brush it on as you're cooking.
Nice.
You don't even need to soak it in there like a marinade for a long time.
And I should point out, this one is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. So if you want to cook this over the weekend, get some of those summery flavors and that honey in there, it's right there for you.
And if people at home have some honey handy and they want to work it into a recipe tonight or this weekend, any good places to look to put some honey in a recipe?
Well, I think something really, really simple and also shockingly sophisticated is to use it on a cheese plate. And so what I like to do is I like to take a pear or even an apple that's really ripe and slice it thinly and put some ricotta cheese on top of that, some nice fresh billowy ricotta, and then drizzle that with some honey and then even sprinkle it with a little smoked paprika. So, again, you've got all these complementary flavors that really round out the flavor of the dish when you take a bite of everything. So that's a really simple way to use it. A way that might be a little more complex is to replace maple syrup with honey. Like, let's say you like to make granola at home. You could add honey instead of maple to your granola mixture. And you'll definitely get some of that honey flavor in there, but it won't be overwhelming. So I think those are two really simple ways to incorporate honey.
Well, Ian, thanks again for being here, and say hello to your bees for us.
Oh, I will. I'm sure they'll say hi back.
Excellent. We've been talking to Ian Knauer. He's a food writer, beekeeper, of course, gardener, and host of the forthcoming PBS series called The Farm, based on his cookbook by the same name. Coming up on Monday on Central Time, astronomer Phil Plate will be joining us. He's going to talk about the northern lights. He's going to talk about what they are and whether or not this might be a good year to actually see the northern lights if you don't live in the far north of Wisconsin.
And he'll tell us why they happen, too. He's always a lot of fun on those astronomy stories. Also, we'll hear about how our emails and online accounts are easily hacked and what we can do to protect ourselves.
Also, we'll talk to a former Apostle Island historian about lighthouses on Lake Superior.
That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the history of censorship in America.
Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. We turn now to censorship in America. The First Amendment grants some pretty strong protections for freedom of speech, but there have been restrictions over time, most notably today, FCC broadcast regulations.
And our next guest says there's a temptation to believe that even a mild form of censorship, like broadcast bleeping, is a curtailment of that freedom. But she says the truth is more complicated than that.
Joining us now is Maria Bustillos. She's a writer based in Los Angeles. Her piece, Curses, The Birth of the Bleep and Modern American Censorship, appeared on The Verge. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What got you started thinking about censorship?
Well, I'm a First Amendment fanatic, kind of. You know, being a journalist, it comes up all the time. You know, the idea that you should be able to be free to say what you want, and I've, you know, defended some unpopular writers on all kinds of different subjects, from like pickup artists to like unpopular political viewpoints in my work, because I think a lot of times people are unfairly silenced, or there's an attempt to silence people, and I'm like really like against that. So in talking with my editors at The Verge, we kind of came up with that in itself as like a worthy topic to sort of focus on.
Well, I mentioned the right to free speech, of course, in the First Amendment. But there have been limits on that over time. Why did we start, or when, I guess, did we start to see censorship and issues over blocking what people are saying in American society?
As I wrote in the piece, in 1921, before there was actually a national broadcast network, there were already attempts to silence people on political grounds, because during the First War, the government had taken over what little then existed of radio. And at the end of the war, they tried to maintain monopoly control over it, the Navy, basically, and Congress wouldn't let them. But there was a very fragile concept of public ownership of the airwaves, like who would wind up owning them, whether it would be like a government-controlled thing or whether it would be private industry or whether it would revert to government. So Westinghouse owned a radio station. You know, these radio stations didn't have very much range at that time, but there was still like this really novel thing that a lot of people were interested in. And they were very afraid that if they put a foot wrong anywhere, you know, Congress would take back the right to broadcast. So there was an actress in 1921 named Olga Petrova who was a campaigner for birth control rights. And at that time, there were Comstock laws that were still in effect that forbade discussion or dissemination of any information about birth control. And so she went on the radio and read, you know, kind of lulled her hosts into a false sense of security by saying she was going to read Mother Goose rhymes and of her own, you know, rewriting. And so they're like, yay, fine. This is a very famous actress, a vaudeville actress. She starts reading, you know, there was once an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children because she didn't know what to do. And this was like a hint for people, like as much as she felt like she could get away with saying she was, you know, friends with Margaret Sanger and, you know, had been a campaigner for this. So some people knew what she was talking about. But they completely freaked out And so that was when a system was devised that in case anything kind of hairy got on the air, the engineer would be able to switch over to a phonograph playing music.
So, and if somebody, and so it was more a political issue then. If somebody came on, I think you mentioned, and started giving pro-communist messages on the air, we might get flipped over to the phonograph.
Exactly.
And later, after the phonograph, we started to hear a distinctive noise. I won't say anything bad, but let's trigger a noise anyway. Okay. We got your laugh over that, too, and it wasn't bleeped out. That's the bleep. What was the birth of the bleep in the United States?
The actual sound has eluded me, I'm sorry to tell you, because there was so much private use of radio. It was definitely at some point in the 1920s, as far as I can make out, at some stage, one of these small radio stations started using this sound, and it became a convention. But I haven't been able to figure out where the very first one was. And I tried. Nobody knew at the Museum of Television, at the Paley Center. I called like all kinds of radio historians, and nobody could help me. So I'll be thrilled if one of your listeners knows.
So it's still a mystery. But at this time, are we still, I mean, it was interesting to hear that, you know, now we worry about getting fined by the FCC. Back then, they were worried about all of radio everywhere being taken away from private hands. Was that still an issue around the time the bleep arose?
I think there, what usually would happen is that people would have their licenses threatened. Mm-hmm. Like, it was pretty fast. Like, by 1927, it was pretty clear that there was going to be, like, a kind of public-private, you know, national radio network that would be overseen somewhat, that there would be some regulation, you know, by government, because there were, at first there were no restrictions, say, like everybody could broadcast over the same frequency. And there started to be chaos almost immediately as, you know, power started, you know, more powerful transmitters started being invented, there started being real problems. And so it was clear that there needed to be some kind of bureau just to, you know, issue licenses and make sure that people weren't just like crazily broadcasting over the same frequencies. So it became like in 1927, I think, was like the first government, like the precursor of the FCC happened at that point. And when people got in trouble thereafter, it was individual licenses that were threatened. But like over those 6 years, there was a lot of like negotiating back and forth, like between different companies that had different patents on different elements of the technology, and government wanting to have a hand in regulating. So it's, there's some really interesting stuff about this. Particularly, I recommend Eric Barnoff on the subject. He has a big, long history of broadcasting, a three-volume one that is just really detailed and really great.
Now, people, we were talking about this as a form of censorship and bleeping as censorship, but you kind of like the bleep, I get the impression. Why is the bleep, if we're going to cut things out, a good way to do it?
Nowadays, what we have is a thing called the dump button, which conceals that there's ever been anything removed from a broadcast. There's a delay, I think it's like 7 seconds or 5 seconds, depending. So if somebody said something that the broadcaster didn't like, it would be removed and the listener would never know that any such thing has happened. My contention is that when there's a bleep, what you're hearing is a discussion. There's a disagreement about, here is something that we consider questionable. And you, the listener, are free to consider why something is being kept from you, what it might be. You have a chance to interrogate, you know, the original performer or speaker, find out what and why. But, I mean, if it's completely hidden from you, you'd never know. And so I contend in my piece that because community standards are the basis of the First Amendment, like what the First Amendment guarantees us is the freedom to decide between ourselves what we consider suitable for public consumption. Nobody wants, you know, like hardcore pornography on some children's station in the middle of the day. Like, these are conventions that society has come up with. These are things that work for us, and it's a little ugly and messy around the edges. Some people disagree. You know, you see a lot of controversy around performers like Howard Stern or people like that who have been given a lot of grief for, you know, pushing the envelope. But basically, there's a conversation taking place. And I kind of do love the bleep as the symbol of that conversation.
But it's hard for, say, a live medium, like, say, a live talk show. We have a dump button here. Our hands are kind of tied. We can't retroactively bleep if we're airing live. If somebody challenges it, what happens on our airwaves? We could pay a bunch of fines to the FCC. What's a live broadcaster to do in that situation?
Well, I'd be really interested to hear, like, your own feelings about the recent decision about fleeting expletives. And, you know, there's a recent Supreme Court decision where the FCC was claiming that they could levy very heavy fines, even for small transgressions against, you know. And the other thing is, the public has to complain, right? There would have to be, like, a huge outcry against you, for instance. Because the FCC can't do this by itself. It has to be in response to a citizen complaining. And that is because you have the right to broadcast whatever you want, unless it offends some member of the public. That's the only way that indecency regulations can kick in. So this recent decision said you cannot, the Supreme Court told the FCC, you can't vaguely say any fleeting expletive, I'm just going to go and fine you, without defining exactly what it is that would constitute a real transgression. And I mean, they're really stuck, in my opinion, because listeners have to be offended by something specific, and the FCC has no control over that. So, you know, I mean, what do you think about it?
I want to, before we take a short break, get to another form of changing words, and this is almost an art form in and of itself, changing movie lines when they go to broadcast TV. Here's a classic piece of American film, Snakes on a Plane, with Samuel L. Jackson as edited for TV. Let's give a listen.
I have had it with these monkey-fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane!
Given that it was Samuel L. Jackson, that was not the original script. Does that... Yeah, we've had a lot of fun with that around the office, I got to say, for like the last year. But does that perform the same functions as a bleep? We know that wasn't the original line. Is that a fun way to call attention to what was really going on there, but not play it and risk getting fined for that?
It's actually beautiful because they chose such surreal words. I mean, that would be safe for a child to hear, right?
Right.
And the grown-ups can know what's being said, and the child will just be like, what?
Yeah. It's up there with Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon in the Die Hard movies. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I talk about that a little bit in the piece, too, how much fun has been had with these conventions over the years, because at the beginning, it very quickly became a subject of comedy. There's a wonderful radio show from 1957. It's a Stan Freiberg piece about, it's called Elderly Man River, where there's a radio censor, and I guess they had like some pretty hardcore ones in the 50s during sort of post-McCarthy years. But the censor is objecting, like, you know, the guy's trying to sing, and it's like, old man, no, you can't say old, that's like really offensive. You have to say elderly. And the whole song is like that, and it's silly and funny. But, like, I mean, even in, you know, the mid-1950s, there was already humor about on this whole topic, and it's the same now. My favorite example recently is from a TV show called Workaholics, where they mixed the kind of words that you had. Like, they were saying clucking, and they're saying, are they saying clucking? They're like, yeah, this is on cable. You know, they're saying, that's why they're saying this, you know, and like, then they start saying clucking to each other, and then all of a sudden one of them actually swears and they bleep it. So
they mix it up, yeah.
Yeah, it's this whole meta comment on, you know, how performers have to move through all these different levels of mediated communication to reach you.
We're talking with Maria Bustillos about modern American censorship, and we want to know what you think. Do you view broadcast regulations as a violation of free speech, the bleeps and the changes, or are you glad they're there? Do they make sense in today's society and today's TV landscape, where you can flip to a cable channel and hear whatever they want to put on there? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion about modern American censorship, the bleeps and bloops on broadcast radio and TV with Maria Bustillos, who wrote an article on the topic, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We'll go to the phones now. We have Lynn on the line in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I personally think that censorship belongs at home. Words are powerless in and of themselves, and when an expletive is used, it's an opportunity for a discussion. So that's where I stand. But I think that the funniest rewrite was from The Big Lebowski, when on TBS they changed a phrase to "See what happens, Larry, when you find a stranger in the Alps." That was
subtle but important change there. Well, and you talk about that, the basic idea there, Maria, that it's up to the user. You can turn it off, you can explain to the kids, or you can set rules. A lot of people make that argument.
Yeah, I've been making it since 1924. The same one, and you see the same thing in you know, Justice Brennan in the Supreme Court said the same thing, and it's extraordinary that it's a struggle that's really never going to be over.
All right, we'll go back to the phones. Oh, thanks for the call, Lynn. We've got Dennis with us in New Berlin. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I'm really enjoying your show. I'm really happy you guys are talking about broadcast-specific censorship. I'm a chief operator at a 10-watt station in Waukesha, and I guess my question, comment, concern is just, you know, you already talked about it on the show already today. So did your guest about how it's really up to the surrounding community to say what obscenity is. And so I listen around to all the different radio stations to find out, like, you know, what I can tell my people at my station, what they can play or not at certain times. But everybody's doing something different. Mm-hmm. But yet these transmitters are reaching in the same range. So I was wondering what your comment would be on that. Why does everybody do it different even though they're all reaching the same people?
Great. Thanks a lot for the call and the kind words. What do you think, Maria?
I think that he's doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing, which is talking about it. I mean, every community has standards which are specific to that community and different people who feel passionately and have ideas to share about it. You know, the more people participate, the better off everybody's going to be and find better solutions so that there's a proper balance struck between people being able to reach their intended audiences and having, you know, enough restraint so that you're not going to offend some people. There's always going to be like a couple of people who are going to be offended probably by almost anything, right? But there's a consensus reached that more or less satisfies everyone, and that's all about participation. I think the caller is doing a great thing by just voicing his opinion. I think that's what we're supposed to be doing.
You know, and we live in a world now where, in addition to the broadcast channels, there's cable where there can be naked people swearing all they want. There's satellite radio where people can say whatever they want. Do you get the sense that the commercial broadcasters are trying to edge up as close as they can to the line, feeling like they have to compete with that?
You know, I didn't get that feeling in my research exactly, because there are some regulations on cable companies. One of the things I did was I went to Comic-Con and talked to some producers and performers in children's television, particularly the animators and producers of a show called Adventure Time, which is on Cartoon Network, because I wanted to know, most of these regulations are to protect children. And people don't want children exposed to what the FCC calls indecency, which, generally speaking, means bodily function stuff, sort of sexual stuff and kind of like excretory stuff. And when I talked with them, they have their own standards and practices offices. All the cable companies have this because there are local regulations on cable companies, even though there aren't federal regulations on them. And they're very, very careful not to cross the line on FCC regulations, particularly where children are concerned, and even when there are just adult programming, because of advertisers. If a lot of people complain to an advertiser about programming that they have found offensive, that will totally reflect on the producers of a TV show and the writers of a TV show. So there's huge amounts of sensitivity, and I think it's done really on the whole more wisely than we are doing it with broadcast TV, where there's an attempt to, you know, exercise control that doesn't necessarily come from the community sometimes. But in the case of cable, they pay very, very close attention to keeping actual people happy, their advertisers, their audiences, parents, you know, and there's, it's very, you know, subtle, careful work that they do. I was really impressed with what I heard from those guys.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jude with us in Denver. Jude, hi.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for including me in this conversation. It's right up my alley. It spurred my curiosity instantly. I'm a songwriter, and a song that I'm often asked to play at small gigs acoustically or what have you happens to have the F word used in it, and it's actually in its title. And something that I've always found really interesting about how to edit that and how to address that has actually been about context. And as she was just mentioning, these things are usually about the bodily function issues. And so if you're using the F word, usually it's connected to that somehow. Yet the context in my song is about frustration. It's F I try. And it's about not giving up and feeling that frustration. But the context doesn't matter with that particular word, because that is one of the very few words that's been decided. They don't really care yet what the context is. And so I've just been dealing with that and trying to decide how to address that. And so I wanted to share that, and then I'll just listen to her off there if it's okay.
Thanks, Jude. So, Maria, yeah, that's one of those words where context is nothing.
One of seven. Seven only.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating because it's really quite arbitrary. I mean, actually, George Carlin decided what those seven words would be. He didn't realize it at the time.
That is weird. Yeah, and we watch those very seven words here at the station to this day. Hey, I'm going to play one more little clip from the King's speech as modified for TV. Let's hear
it. You know the F word?
So, you know, would you like to be in a world where we turn on, say, NBC, watch the King's speech, and we hear that bleep free?
I love it both ways, I have to tell you. It's very funny. And it has, it just kind of reminds you, right, that, like, there's someone thinking about this and looking out for it. I don't have, like, a strong feeling that it should end, but it will end, in fact. If the Supreme Court ever visits the right of the SEC to enforce indecency regulations, and I mean, it happened in the print world with Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell, where the Supreme Court said, you know, it doesn't matter if you're very upset, Mr. Falwell, you kind of lose, you know, and so it may happen someday that the Supreme Court decides that. You know, the FCC has no right to enforce these things, and then bleeping will end forever.
All right, Maria, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Maria Bustillos is a writer based in Los Angeles. Her piece was Curses, The Birth of the Bleep and Modern American Censorship. We've got a link to that Verge article on our Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk about a reported retaliation plot by Iran against the United States if military action is taken against Syria. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Vera. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.